Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Inglés. Nivel C1. Comprensión oral. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
This week, we're going to look at smoking. We know so much about the harmful effects of smoking. We know so much about the addictive nature of smoking. So we wanted to look at a country that has really succeeded in getting smokers to stop and non-smokers not to start in the first place.
So we're off to examine the anti-smoking policies of Australia.
Australia is known for having some of the world's toughest anti-smoking laws. And the country began its anti-smoking campaign in the same way that many other countries in the developed world did, by banning smoking in workplaces and indoor facilities. But then it went one step further to tackle the niche areas in between. And we start our story in Sydney with Mark Driver, who's now the city's parks and recreation planner. He's an ex-smoker himself, by the way.
It's quite common to find smokers congregating on the footpath, and that's creating clouds of smoke and nuisance, what we call smoking hotspots, near public transport, train stations, bus shelters. Now, smoking is prohibited within 10 metres of a playground, within 4 metres of the entrance of a public building, at public transport stops, which include bus stops, rail platforms and taxi ranks.
Now, breaking these laws incurs a fine between $200 and $2,000. But penalties don't always work. One of the key things about trying to persuade people to stop smoking is reminding them that their addiction is bad for them. And in Sydney, they did this in a pretty obvious way.
We converted the bollards at Pitt Street Mall to cigarette butts. When you walk through there, it just looks like a giant has stubbed out his cigarette. So that really gets the attention of the public. Aha, yeah, this is a smoke-free area.
And the benefit isn't just for non-smokers. Here's Simon Chapman, public health professor of Sydney University.
When you can't smoke, say at work, on public transport, in restaurants, bars, your daily cigarette consumption falls by about 20%.
But is that the key to this policy? Our local reporter Zoe Ferguson asks Simon the crucial question.
Which law do you think is most effective in curbing smoking?
The best way of answering that question is to look at which things the tobacco industry reacts most violently against. Over the years, unquestionably, that's been price rises through tax rises. It's very, very difficult these days to buy a packet of cigarettes under $20 Australian a packet. Predictions are that in a few years they will go near $40 a pack.
$20 Australian is about $15 US. So a pack in Australia could set you back $30 US in the future.
The image that tobacco companies use to sell their products has changed dramatically over the years. Just think of the ads. Do you remember the Marlboro Man? This imagery is enormously powerful, and it carried through to the packaging on cigarette packs. So what did Australia do? Well, it blanked out that packaging. In 2012, it was the first country to make plain packaging compulsory.
I've never in the whole of my career seen anything worry the industry quite so much.
Talk me through some of the packaging that we see.
It's a box of the standard colour, and then you see this gigantic, humongous, see and never forget kind of image.
And that's not all. The Australian government also pumped money into an all-guns-blazing media campaign across radio, television and public billboards. In 2010, $85 million was spent on it. And it's a dark campaign, all about the damage and harm that smoking can do. Here's Scott Walsberger, head of tobacco control at Cancer Council, New South Wales.
The evidence shows us that hard-hitting graphic ads that really show the harms of smoking.
So, Professor Henrietta Moore, let's start drilling down on this. It would seem that Australia has a multi-pronged approach: attack the ability to advertise, the ability to actually light up anywhere, enhance the ability to assess the real damage smoking does to you. That surely is what adds up to a result.
Yeah, and it's an impressive result, because smoking rates for adults in Australia have almost halved since 1980 and are now at about 13%. And globally, the rate for adults is about 20%. So Australia's doing well. Declining smoking rates also resulted in Australia in a decrease of almost 23% in the rate of people admitted to hospital as a result of smoking. So that's a noticeable improvement.
Sarah, Australia was one of the first countries to introduce plain packaging. And one of the people that Zoe spoke to said that if it existed before he took up smoking, he might not have been a smoker at all. Do you think that that is one of the most significant pieces of the puzzle?
Yes. Research shows that plain packaging can make cigarettes a lot less appealing when you take away all of that imagery. And Australia's reported declines in prevalence. So, yeah, I do think it's that significant. They're still the only country that's fully implemented it. The UK's in the implementation process, but not all packages are plain yet.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
This week, we're going to look at smoking. We know so much about the harmful effects of smoking. We know so much about the addictive nature of smoking. So we wanted to look at a country that has really succeeded in getting smokers to stop and non-smokers not to start in the first place.
So we're off to examine the anti-smoking policies of Australia.
Australia is known for having some of the world's toughest anti-smoking laws. And the country began its anti-smoking campaign in the same way that many other countries in the developed world did, by banning smoking in workplaces and indoor facilities. But then it went one step further to tackle the niche areas in between. And we start our story in Sydney with Mark Driver, who's now the city's parks and recreation planner. He's an ex-smoker himself, by the way.
It's quite common to find smokers congregating on the footpath, and that's creating clouds of smoke and nuisance. What we call smoking hotspots near public transport, train stations, bus shelters. Now, smoking is prohibited within 10 metres of a playground, within 4 metres of the entrance of a public building, at public transport stops, which include bus stops, rail platforms, and taxi ranks.
Now, breaking these laws incurs a fine between $200 and $2,000, but penalties don't always work. One of the key things about trying to persuade people to stop smoking is reminding them that their addiction is bad for them. And in Sydney, they did this in a pretty obvious way.
We converted the bollards at Pitt Street Mall to cigarette butts. When you walk through there, it just looks like a giant has stubbed out his cigarette. So that really gets the attention of the public. Aha, yeah, this is a smoke-free area.
And the benefit isn't just for non-smokers. Here's Simon Chapman, public health professor of Sydney University.
When you can't smoke, say at work, on public transport, in restaurants, bars, your daily cigarette consumption falls by about 20%.
But is that the key to this policy? Our local reporter Zoe Ferguson asks Simon the crucial question.
Which law do you think is most effective in curbing smoking?
The best way of answering that question is to look at which things the tobacco industry reacts most violently against. Over the years, unquestionably, that's been price rises through tax rises. It's very, very difficult these days to buy a packet of cigarettes under $20 Australian a packet. The predictions are that in a few years they will go near $40 a pack.
$20 Australian is about $15 US. So a pack in Australia could set you back $30 US in the future.
The image that tobacco companies use to sell their products has changed dramatically over the years. Just think of the ads. Do you remember the Marlboro Man? This imagery is enormously powerful, and it carried through to the packaging on cigarette packs. So what did Australia do? Well, it blanked out that packaging. In 2012, it was the first country to make plain packaging compulsory.
I've never in the whole of my career seen anything worry the industry quite so much.
Talk me through some of the packaging that we see.
It's a box with a standard colour, and then you see this gigantic, humongous see and never forget kind of image.
And that's not all. The Australian government also pumped money into an all-guns-blazing media campaign across radio, television and public billboards. In 2010, $85 million was spent on it. And it's a dark campaign, all about the damage and harm that smoking can do. Here's Scott Walsberger, head of tobacco control at Cancer Council, New South Wales.
The evidence shows us that hard-hitting graphic ads that really show the harms of smoking.
So, Professor Henrietta Moore, let's start drilling down on this. It would seem that Australia has a multi-pronged approach, attack the ability to advertise, the ability to actually light up anywhere, enhance the ability to assess the real damage smoking does to you. That surely is what adds up to a result.
Yeah, and it's an impressive result because smoking rates for adults in Australia have almost halved since 1980 and are now at about 13%. And globally, the rate for adults is about 20%. So Australia's doing well. Declining smoking rates also resulted in Australia in a decrease of almost 23% in the rate of people admitted to hospital as a result of smoking. So that's a noticeable improvement.
Sarah, Australia was one of the first countries to introduce plain packaging. And one of the people that Zoe spoke to said that if it existed before he took up smoking, he might not have been a smoker at all. Do you think that that is one of the most significant pieces of the puzzle?
Yes. Research shows that plain packaging can make cigarettes a lot less appealing when you take away all of that imagery. And Australia's reported declines in prevalence. So, yeah, I do think it's that significant. They're still the only country that's fully implemented it. The UK's in the implementation process, but not all packages are plain yet.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
This week, we're going to look at smoking. We know so much about the harmful effects of smoking. We know so much about the addictive nature of smoking. So we wanted to look at a country that has really succeeded in getting smokers to stop and non-smokers not to start in the first place.
So we're off to examine the anti-smoking policies of Australia.
Australia is known for having some of the world's toughest anti-smoking laws. And the country began its anti-smoking campaign in the same way that many other countries in the developed world did, by banning smoking in workplaces and indoor facilities. But then it went one step further to tackle the niche areas in between. And we start our story in Sydney with Mark Driver, who's now the city's parks and recreation planner. He's an ex-smoker himself, by the way.
It's quite common to find smokers congregating on the footpath, and that's creating clouds of smoke and nuisance. What we call smoking hotspots near public transport, train stations, bus shelters. Now, smoking is prohibited within 10 metres of a playground, within 4 metres of the entrance of a public building, at public transport stops, which include bus stops, rail platforms, and taxi ranks.
Now, breaking these laws incurs a fine between $200 and $2,000. But penalties don't always work. One of the key things about trying to persuade people to stop smoking is reminding them that their addiction is bad for them. And in Sydney, they did this in a pretty obvious way.
We converted the bollards at Pitt Street Mall to cigarette butts. When you walk through there, it just looks like a giant has stubbed out his cigarette. So that really gets the attention of the public. Aha, yeah, this is a smoke-free area.
And the benefit isn't just for non-smokers. Here's Simon Chapman, public health professor of Sydney University.
When you can't smoke, say, at work, on public transport, in restaurants, bars, your daily cigarette consumption falls by about 20%.
But is that the key to this policy? Our local reporter Zoe Ferguson asks Simon the crucial question.
Which law do you think is most effective in curbing smoking?
The best way of answering that question is to look at which things the tobacco industry reacts most violently against. Over the years, unquestionably, that's been price rises through tax rises. It's very, very difficult these days to buy a packet of cigarettes under $20 Australian a packet. Predictions are that in a few years they will go near $40 a pack.
$20 Australian is about $15 US. So a pack in Australia could set you back $30 US in the future.
The image that tobacco companies use to sell their products has changed dramatically over the years. Just think of the ads. Do you remember the Marlboro Man? This imagery is enormously powerful, and it carried through to the packaging on cigarette packs. So what did Australia do? Well, it blanked out that packaging. In 2012, it was the first country to make plain packaging compulsory.
I've never in the whole of my career seen anything worry the industry quite so much.
Talk me through some of the packaging that we see.
It's a box with a standard colour, and then you see this gigantic, humongous, see and never forget kind of image.
And that's not all. The Australian government also pumped money into an all-guns-blazing media campaign across radio, television and public billboards. In 2010, $85 million was spent on it. And it's a dark campaign, all about the damage and harm that smoking can do. Here's Scott Walsberger, head of tobacco control at Cancer Council, New South Wales.
The evidence shows us that hard-hitting graphic ads that really show the harms of smoking.
So, Professor Henrietta Moore, let's start drilling down on this. It would seem that Australia has a multi-pronged approach: attack the ability to advertise, the ability to actually light up anywhere, enhance the ability to assess the real damage smoking does to you. That surely is what adds up to a result.
Yeah, and it's an impressive result, because smoking rates for adults in Australia have almost halved since 1980 and are now at about 13%. And globally, the rate for adults is about 20%. So Australia's doing well. Declining smoking rates also resulted in Australia in a decrease of almost 23% in the rate of people admitted to hospital as a result of smoking. So that's a noticeable improvement.
Sarah, Australia was one of the first countries to introduce plain packaging. And one of the people that Zoe spoke to said that if it existed before he took up smoking, he might not have been a smoker at all. Do you think that that is one of the most significant pieces of the puzzle?
Yes. Research shows that plain packaging can make cigarettes a lot less appealing when you take away all of that imagery. And Australia's reported declines in prevalence. So, yeah, I do think it's that significant. They're still the only country that's fully implemented it. The UK is in the implementation process, but not all packages are plain yet.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
Yes, it's quite an unusual thing if you stop to think about it, because you don't tend to see it in other animals.
That's exactly right. We don't see any emotional or psychic tears, as they are known in other animals.
Extract 1.
There are indeed, and top of the charts are women in Turkey.
What about the other end of the list? Who are the least criers?
Is men in Bulgaria.
Well, they do come across as extremely emotionally resilient. That's the impression that I get from afar.
Extract 2.
Right, so you see, it's a complex secretomotor phenomenon characterised by the shedding of saline from the lacrimal apparatus, often accompanied by sobbing, which is a convulsive inhaling and exhaling of air with spasms of the respiratory and truncal muscle groups.
Extract 3.
It begins in the lacrimal gland, or known as the tear duct, in the upper outer part of the eye. And when you blink, you spread that. It's very strange, but actually what happens is that tear has spread across your eye very thinly, and it's collected at the lacrimal punctum, which is that little fleshy bit that you can see sticking out the inner lower part of your eye.
Extract 4.
And that's like your drain for the tear. And the tear actually should go into that, like a sink plug hole, down the drain and out your nose, which is why you get a runny nose. Now, the reason that we get overflowing of tears is because that drain essentially gets blocked up. There's an overflow and the flooding begins.
Extract 5.
The first is the worker tear, which is called the basal tear, and that's essentially to keep the eye nourished. Now, the other tear is called the reflex tear. So if you get an irritant in your eye, like an onion, or if you're unfortunate to be in a riot and get pepper sprayed, that is the sort of tear that you're going to produce. So the purpose of that is actually to try and wash away any dirt or debris that's sitting on the eye. Now, the final tear, the most important tear, is the crying tear. And this is one that is triggered by a range of emotions. So you can cry because of pain, sadness, distress, happiness, joy, shock. This tear is the one that causes the most interest.
Extract 6.
Charles Darwin thought that the reason that babies cried was that if you screwed up your face for long enough, it would force tears to come out of your eyes.
Psychologist and broadcaster Claudia Hammond, author of Emotional Roller Coaster.
And so one day in his study, he had loads of children, and one day in his study, he got them lined up in front of him, and he asked them to screw up their faces for 45 minutes to see whether this would make them cry. And, of course, funnily enough, it did, probably because they didn't like standing there for 45 minutes. And so he concluded that emotional tears don't have any real purpose. Tears are just there to protect your eyes.
Extract 7.
Now, psychologists today do think that crying has a purpose, and there's still a bit of a debate about exactly what that purpose is. But many psychologists think it's all about communication, and that if you cry, usually other people are nice to you. So if they were teasing you, they might realise they've gone a bit far, and usually they'll comfort you.
Extract 8.
Joyful tears are a bit of a mystery. But again, it could be about communication, that you are communicating to other people that this is one of the most amazing, joyful moments of your life, and it's your daughter's wedding or your own wedding, and these tears just spill forth.
Extract 9.
But what was new in this study is that we also measured after 20 minutes and after 90 minutes. And then we saw there's not just a recovery to baseline, but significantly better. So it might indeed be the case that crying has a positive effect on mood, but it takes some time.
Extract 10.
Maybe crying stimulates the release in the brain of certain substances, such as oxytocin or endogenous opioids, which have these mood-enhancing effects. If that would be the case, that would also imply that it might have effects on our pain perception. And that's what we are now working on in our current study. We are not just measuring mood, but we also subjected the study participants to a painful stimulus. And then we record how long they can endure that.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Yes, it's quite an unusual thing if you stop to think about it, because you don't tend to see it in other animals.
That's exactly right. We don't see any emotional or psychic tears, as they are known in other animals.
Extract 1.
There are indeed, and top of the charts are women in Turkey.
What about the other end of the list? Who are the least criers?
Is men in Bulgaria.
Well, they do come across as extremely emotionally resilient. That's the impression that I get from afar.
Extract 2.
Right, so you see, it's a complex secretomotor phenomenon characterised by the shedding of saline from the lacrimal apparatus, often accompanied by sobbing, which is a convulsive inhaling and exhaling of air with spasms of the respiratory and truncal muscle groups.
Extract 3.
It begins in the lacrimal gland, or known as the tear duct, in the upper outer part of the eye. And when you blink, you spread that. It's very strange, but actually what happens is that tear has spread across your eye very thinly, and it's collected at the lacrimal punctum, which is that little fleshy bit that you can see sticking out the inner lower part of your eye.
Extract 4.
And that's like your drain for the tear. And the tear actually should go into that, like a sink plug hole, down the drain and out your nose, which is why you get a runny nose. Now, the reason that we get overflowing of tears is because that drain essentially gets blocked up. There's an overflow and the flooding begins.
Extract 5.
The first is the worker tear, which is called the basal tear, and that's essentially to keep the eye nourished. Now, the other tear is called the reflex tear. So if you get an irritant in your eye, like an onion, or if you're unfortunate to be in a riot and get pepper sprayed, that is the sort of tear that you're going to produce. So the purpose of that is actually to try and wash away any dirt or debris that's sitting on the eye. Now, the final tear, the most important tear, is the crying tear. And this is one that is triggered by a range of emotions. So you can cry because of pain, sadness, distress, happiness, joy, shock. This tear is the one that causes the most interest.
Extract 6.
Charles Darwin thought that the reason that babies cried was that if you screwed up your face for long enough, it would force tears to come out of your eyes.
Psychologist and broadcaster Claudia Hammond, author of Emotional Rollercoaster.
And so one day in his study, he had loads of children, and one day in his study, he got them lined up in front of him, and he asked them to screw up their faces for 45 minutes to see whether this would make them cry. And, of course, funnily enough, it did, probably because they didn't like standing there for 45 minutes. And so he concluded that emotional tears don't have any real purpose. Tears are just there to protect your eyes.
Extract 7.
Now, psychologists today do think that crying has a purpose, and there's still a bit of a debate about exactly what that purpose is. But many psychologists think it's all about communication, and that if you cry, usually other people are nice to you. So if they were teasing you, they might realise they've gone a bit far, and usually they'll comfort you.
Extract 8.
Joyful tears are a bit of a mystery. But again, it could be about communication, that you are communicating to other people that this is one of the most amazing, joyful moments of your life, and it's your daughter's wedding or your own wedding, and these tears just spill forth.
Extract 9.
But what was new in this study is that we also measured after 20 minutes and after 90 minutes. And then we saw there's not just a recovery to baseline, but significantly better. So it might indeed be the case that crying has a positive effect on mood, but it takes some time.
Extract 10.
Maybe crying stimulates the release in the brain of certain substances, such as oxytocin or endogenous opioids, which have these mood-enhancing effects. If that would be the case, that would also imply that it might have effects on our pain perception. And that's what we are now working on in our current study. We are not just measuring mood, but we also subjected the study participants to a painful stimulus. And then we record how long they can endure that.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Ahora, escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
Yes, it's quite an unusual thing if you stop to think about it, because you don't tend to see it in other animals.
That's exactly right. We don't see any emotional or psychic tears, as they are known in other animals.
Extract 1.
There are indeed, and top of the charts are women in Turkey.
What about the other end of the list? Who are the least criers?
Is men in Bulgaria.
Well, they do come across as extremely emotionally resilient. That's the impression that I get from afar.
Extract 2.
Right, so you see, it's a complex secretomotor phenomenon characterised by the shedding of saline from the lacrimal apparatus, often accompanied by sobbing, which is a convulsive inhaling and exhaling of air with spasms of the respiratory and truncal muscle groups.
Extract 3.
It begins in the lacrimal gland, or known as the tear duct, in the upper outer part of the eye. And when you blink, you spread that. It's very strange, but actually what happens is that tear has spread across your eye very thinly, and it's collected at the lacrimal punctum, which is that little fleshy bit that you can see sticking out the inner lower part of your eye.
Extract 4.
And that's like your drain for the tear. And the tear actually should go into that, like a sink plug hole, down the drain and out your nose, which is why you get a runny nose. Now, the reason that we get overflowing of tears is because that drain essentially gets blocked up. There's an overflow and the flooding begins.
Extract 5.
The first is the worker tear, which is called the basal tear, and that's essentially to keep the eye nourished. Now, the other tear is called the reflex tear. So if you get an irritant in your eye, like an onion, or if you're unfortunate to be in a riot and get pepper sprayed, that is the sort of tear that you're going to produce. So the purpose of that is actually to try and wash away any dirt or debris that's sitting on the eye. Now, the final tear, the most important tear, is the crying tear. And this is one that is triggered by a range of emotions. So you can cry because of pain, sadness, distress, happiness, joy, shock. This tear is the one that causes the most interest.
Extract 6.
Charles Darwin thought that the reason that babies cried was that if you screwed up your face for long enough, it would force tears to come out of your eyes.
Psychologist and broadcaster Claudia Hammond, author of Emotional Rollercoaster.
And so one day in his study, he had loads of children, and one day in his study, he got them lined up in front of him, and he asked them to screw up their faces for 45 minutes to see whether this would make them cry. And, of course, funnily enough, it did, probably because they didn't like standing there for 45 minutes. And so he concluded that emotional tears don't have any real purpose. Tears are just there to protect your eyes.
Extract 7.
Now, psychologists today do think that crying has a purpose, and there's still a bit of a debate about exactly what that purpose is. But many psychologists think it's all about communication, and that if you cry, usually other people are nice to you. So if they were teasing you, they might realise they've gone a bit far, and usually they'll comfort you.
Extract 8.
Joyful tears are a bit of a mystery. But again, it could be about communication, that you are communicating to other people that this is one of the most amazing, joyful moments of your life, and it's your daughter's wedding or your own wedding, and these tears just spill forth.
Extract 9.
But what was new in this study is that we also measured after 20 minutes and after 90 minutes. And then we saw there's not just a recovery to baseline, but significantly better. So it might indeed be the case that crying has a positive effect on mood, but it takes some time.
Extract 10.
Maybe crying stimulates the release in the brain of certain substances, such as oxytocin or endogenous opioids, which have these mood-enhancing effects. If that would be the case, that would also imply that it might have effects on our pain perception. And that's what we are now working on in our current study. We are not just measuring mood, but we also subjected the study participants to a painful stimulus. And then we record how long they can endure that.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.